Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Apple, YouTube and Sainsbury's. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Shouldn't use time-specific greetings on a podcast that people can listen to at any time, should I? Shouldn't say good morning, good evening, good afternoon.
No.
So, hi. There Hello. We go. That's better.
And welcome, listeners, whatever time of the day or night you happen to be listening to this. What were we talking about last week? Sounds Like Friday Night. Did you watch Sounds Like Friday Night?
I did not watch Sounds Like Friday Night.
I did because I thought, research, I better watch that.
We did say we were going to watch it last week. I didn't watch that other thing you were talking about either, the documentary. About, what was the documentary about?
Nile Rodgers.
The Nile Rodgers documentary.
Well, that was 3 hours long. Sounds Like Friday Night was 30 minutes.
So Sounds Like Friday Night, in case you don't know, is the new primetime music show from the BBC on BBC Channel 1, aimed at the kids who don't know what BBC One is. I assume it's also on the iPlayer.
That's where I watched it.
Is it also on YouTube?
I don't know.
I imagine a lot of the youth...
I'm too old to go on YouTube.
...don't even know what the iPlayer is. But it's not just for the kids. It's for all music fans everywhere. It's pop music back in prime time. It's not the new Top of the Pops, but it's sort of the new Top of the Pops.
Sort of is.
What's it called? Sounds Like Friday Night.
I think that's what it's called.
That's what I'm calling it. If it turns out that no one's tuning in, what time was it on at? Oh, you wouldn't know because you watched it off the iPlayer.
I know Friday from the title. That's as far as I'll take it.
Because with Top of the Pops... In that decade when Top of the Pops was quietly, slowly dying, they kept moving it around schedule. So it used to be in the classic Thursday evening slot. And then they moved it to Friday at 7.30 before finally sticking it into Sunday night when that was complete failure. But Friday 7.30 puts it up against Coronation Street. And I know we all tend to think Coronation Street's only watched by old people, but it's not. It's watched by a lot of people of all ages.
No one I know.
If you put it up against Coronation Street, that makes it really hard to find an audience. My point is, if it doesn't get an audience in whatever time slot they've put it in, and they go, all right, next time, because it's only going to be 6 episodes, I think. But I assume if it works, the plan is to make it a more long-term thing.
Yeah.
But if they decide that it would be better on Tuesday night, kind of ruined it with the title, haven't they? Because I mean, it sounds like Tuesday night. I mean, that doesn't make sense, does it? So it's a very brave title. So I don't know whether that means that they're assuming 6 episodes, it'll be written off as a failure, and then they'll just forget it. Or whether they are very confident that not only is this going to be a successful new pop music show in primetime, it's going to run for a long time in its Friday night slot. Even though, as discussed, the night it goes out is sort of irrelevant in the iPlayer YouTube age. Anyway, was it any good?
Well, it was better than you thought it was going to be.
Well, I thought it was going to be shit. So it was better than shit. Yeah. They could use that. You should.
Given that we can't discuss this because you haven't watched it, should I just give you my quick observations about it?
Well, first of all, tell us, because obviously it's not like Top of the Pops and it's not just people singing songs and then a chart countdown at the end. There's
no chart countdown.
Who cares about the chart? They're right to not include the chart. Yeah. So what does the 30 minutes consist of?
Well, a lot of talking.
Yes.
A lot of talking. I mean, like more talking than you would think. For a 30-minute music show. It felt like there was 30 minutes of talking, but there were 4 song performances in there. So they showed a video, but they only showed like 30 seconds of it because there clearly wasn't time because they had to do more talking.
And what were they talking about and to whom were they talking? So there's 3 presenters in total because there's 2 regular presenters and then a guest host every week.
Yes, and this week was Jason Derulo. And that is another issue I identified in that it really relies heavily on that guest pop star presenter being good at it. And Jason Derulo, luckily, was pretty good at it and pretty funny. But anyone who's not good at that is going to destroy that show.
Well, this initial run, I think it's only 6 editions. So surely there are 6 pop stars who can do that. But if it was to become like, you know...
They did a little chat with him and Charlie Puth as well. And that worked quite well. They had a bit of... Because they toured together, they had a bit of camaraderie. But like the moment you don't have that... I mean, they did an out-of-the-studio sketch with Dave Grohl that was just... Like, Dave Grohl's a funny man, and that sketch was awful.
It was the comedy skits, which was...
That was what didn't work.
They were bigged up from the start, because the people...
They had funny man Dave Grohl, and they had some comedians, neither of whom did anything remotely funny.
But it's the comedy skits was the main basis on which I was predicting this programme would be shit. So therefore, the thing that I was basing that opinion on was shit, but fortunately it was just one very, very small part of the programme.
The Dave Grohl sketch felt like it went on a long time.
Well, it can't have done if it was 30 minutes and there were four songs and a bit of a video
that
and all
like
of this talking that went on forever. But I suppose if it was to go that it was on like 50 weeks of the year, then they probably would struggle to find a decent pop star guest host every single week, and they'd probably start stretching
because it
that.
Really, really hangs on that pop star guest.
Now, by the time this podcast goes out, the second edition will have gone out of Sounds Like Friday Night. Do we know who the guest host is going to be for edition number two?
No. I mean, they probably announced that.
We probably should.
They probably
have
said
that
it in the show, but
so it'll be interesting to see whoever the guest host is this week is any good, and if not, whether that proves your point that the show makes or breaks on its guest hosts.
Yeah. Now, before we get into our podcast this week, I want to recommend another podcast.
Do.
Which is dangerous up front, isn't it? Recommending people go and listen to another podcast before you've started your own.
Well, last week we did recommend that people go off and watch a 3-hour
that's true.
Documentary on iPlayer. And I realise that's a documentary, not a podcast, and this is podcast against podcast. But it has sort of become part of the format that before we get started, we tell people to go off and listen to something else. But it is a very good podcast that you're
it
about
is.
To tip.
Yeah, someone on Twitter whose name I have now completely failed to note down... But thank you very much. I recommended a podcast called And the Writer Is. And specifically, they recommended the latest episode of it. So basically, this podcast, it's normally interviews with songwriters about their careers and their songwriting process, like quite in-depth, long interviews. And this week's edition is an interview with the head of the National Music Publishers Association in the US, David Israelite, about the songwriting and publishing business. And it's a really interesting interview that covers a lot of issues that we've discussed on this show before and gets a different perspective on some of them. And there's information I didn't know, so that was useful. It was, it's good.
We should note the interviewer is a very successful songwriter.
Yes, and one who's quite active in lobbying for change in the songwriting industry. Ross Golan, who's written for everyone. Flo Rida, I think Ariana Grande. The list is huge. I've now completed I looked up the list of all his songs and it was huge and I couldn't memorise any of it.
And I think what's interesting is, obviously, usually the whole USP of this podcast is that it is one very successful songwriter talking to another very successful songwriter. But it was almost as, if not more interesting, having a very successful songwriter talking to someone who comes from totally the commercial side of the music industry.
And represents the publishers, not the songwriters, although he was saying that he feels that the songwriters are part of his remit.
Yes, and as part of that, the major publishers, as well as the indies, etc. So it is a very interesting interview, and I think that the two things that I took away from it, it's about an hour and...
It's almost an hour and a half.
But it doesn't feel like an hour and a half.
No, not at all.
So you just have to set aside the time and then it should be pleasurable to listen to. The two things that I thought were interesting is that we've talked at length about the complexities around the streaming business. And there are lots of issues and challenges which are making it tricky for artists and songwriters in particular to adapt to the streaming business. We've talked about them endlessly on this podcast. If you read Dissecting the Digital Dollar, we go into it there. But when it comes to songwriters in the US, I think it is definitely true to say that the single biggest problem is dumb copyright law. Okay, there are certain elements of American copyright law which are, A, almost unique to the US. They are different to what we have over here in Europe. And they're stupid. And what David Israelite does a really good job of explaining is, first of all, the history as to why America ended up with stupid copyright law.
Yeah, how songwriters are paid through streaming services is governed by laws that date back to 1909 and 1949.
And they were stupid laws then.
Yeah.
And they're even more stupid laws now. But even more interesting than that was his explanation. And I suppose in some ways, obviously, he's the chief lobbyist for the music publishers. So in some ways, he was defending, because there's an element of, well, why haven't you got these laws changed? That's your job. But I think his explanation about why it has been so hard for songwriters and music publishers to get those laws changed, even though in some ways he's defending his organization's performance, but... His points are very legitimate and also, beyond talking about music publishing, a fascinating insight into the lobbying industry and particularly the American lobbying industry. And basically it comes down to the fact that the decision makers in Congress are very influenced by their local constituents in the states that they represent. And the problem is for the music industry that the vast majority of both songwriters and music publishers are in one of three cities, which is LA, New York, and Nashville.
Yeah.
So that's three states where you have friends in Congress. But then all the other states in America, well, his point was one of the big lobbies on the other side is the broadcasting industry. And every single state in America has radio stations.
Yeah.
So every single senator and representative in Congress has radio stations lobbying them. But a lot of the songwriters and music publishers, they're lobbying a very small set of people in Congress. And that's one of the reasons why the broadcasters tend to get their way. And then the second thing which was interesting was talking about, as songwriters, your assumption is your friends in Congress or the Democrats booed the Republicans, because I suppose songwriters, I mean, he does make the distinction in the podcast, Ross, doesn't he, that perhaps this isn't true of the Nashville songwriters necessarily.
Yeah.
But certainly in LA and New York, the songwriters are the most liberal, left-leaning, easygoing groups of people that you will find. And so therefore, politically, they feel more in line with the Democrats. But actually, often, it's the Republicans in Washington who fight the corner of songwriters.
Yeah, the people who are more keen on kind of a free market trade, that sort of thing.
And they're also saying that the Democrats have, in recent years, been very close to the tech sector. And the tech sector does brilliant things, and they should be supported. And indeed, the Republicans are close to the tech sector, too. But he was saying, and it would be interesting to get to talk to sort of Democrat supporting, that's sort of the Jay-Z's of this world, who are very openly supportive of the Democrat Party and everything that stands for. And was a big supporter of Obama. And in this interview, David Israelite basically says, as a songwriter, because of your politics, you may think that Obama achieved a huge amount in his 8 years as president, and he probably did. But David Israelite's point is, for songwriters, he achieved fuck all. he didn't do anything for songwriters. In fact, if anything, he set songwriters back, was David Israelite's opinion on that. And I suppose the positive spin of that was that perhaps, for all of the issues around the current regime in Washington,
of
which there are many, there may be some opportunities there for songwriters and their publishers to finally fix this stupid American copyright law. And it's not the only issue. There's still lots of other issues around the streaming business. Which they also discuss, and we have also discussed. But there is an element of, if you don't fix the mechanical right compulsory license and the consent decrees governing BMI and ASCAP, then you need to get those fixed before you address everything else. And so it's very interesting. As some, well, actually two people, so him representing the publishers, and then this Ross Golan, who's a very active songwriter in this space. So two people who, from different sides, are very much fighting for this, and it was very interesting to hear them talk.
Yes, so that's called And the Writer Is... You can probably find it wherever you found this show. Go and listen to it after you've listened to this show.
And we're going to
cue it up now. Don't press play until we've finished talking.
We're going to be really speedy this week.
Yeah.
So therefore, you can listen to us, then listen to them. We have to be speedy because we're on a very tight deadline today.
Yeah.
So tell us what we're going to talk about, and then we'll talk about it really speedy.
Well, we'll be talking about how a supermarket chain Sainsbury's is setting up a new record label, the songwriters sharing their gripes with YouTube via adverts on YouTube. But first, Apple's new HomePod device and the fact that Siri, who you will be able to chat to on this device, will ignore any demands you make to play music via any streaming service other than Apple Music.
Yes, so this all relates to the HomePod, which is Apple's play in the voice-activated home device. So basically, this is Apple going head-to-head with Amazon, who obviously have the Echo device, which is controlled by Alexa, and then Google have the Google Home device, which is controlled by Google. Hey, Google. Hey, Alexa. And so Apple is finally coming to market ahead of Christmas in a number of markets. US, I think the UK, there was a number of markets. It will be coming out in the next few weeks, and they're going to enter the market with their competitor to the Echo device and the Google Home device. So it's one of those devices where you get to shout instructions at it, and then it will do stuff for you. So, for example, people I know who've got Echo devices, I don't think I know anybody with a Google Home device, although people have bought them.
I can think of one person.
Can you? Well,
yeah.
Done.
But I've not seen it.
I suppose the thing about the Echo device, because it's linked to Amazon, and if you live in London, Amazon now can get stuff to your house really quickly. So actually, one of the biggest things that the Echo device does for people who live in London is you can say, hey, Alexa, I'm out of coffee. Bring me coffee. And then within an hour, somebody arrives on a bike and gives you coffee, and it's all charged to your Amazon account. But you can also chat to people and organise lists and do any sort of stuff that you might previously have done through your smartphone or your computer or whatever. And of course, all of these devices will play you music on demand when you shout at it to play you music. And it's interesting that Apple in particular, when they announced that they were coming with their HomePod earlier this year, more so than both Amazon and Google, are really pushing the music element of their device to the fore.
Yeah, so they build the HomePod as the powerful speaker that sounds amazing and provides instant access to Apple Music. And you might notice there, it doesn't mention a long list of streaming services. That is where the quote finishes, just Apple Music. And that was confirmed last week when Apple put out instructions for third-party developers who want to build apps for this device, which stipulated that they would only be accepting apps classified as messaging, lists, and notes. You can't squeeze a music streaming service into any of those classifications, I don't think. Maybe lists, playlists, no. I don't think they're going to accept it.
I don't think they are. And it's worth noting, this isn't a surprise. We basically knew this was coming. What happened last week was we got the confirmation.
I mean, this is the same as other Apple devices. You can't say to Siri on your iPhone, play me music on Spotify, because Siri will say, I don't know what that means.
And with those other devices that have the Siri integration, it's also true that when they first launched, Apple only made Siri integration available to a small number of apps in terms of categories, like that list that you've just read out. Although as things have developed, they have added other categories to those lists. But crucially, what they've never added is music services. So obviously, both Amazon with their Echo device and Google with their Google Home device, they both have streaming services.
Yes, and they push their streaming services up front. Well, there's the whole thing with Amazon that you get different tiers of music streaming service for different prices on the Echo device. So you can pay as little as £4 a month if you want to only listen to music via Amazon's service on your Echo speaker.
That's true. So although, as we said, it feels like Apple are pushing music much more with their device versus Amazon and Google. But you're right. Having said that, obviously music is core to the Amazon device in that one of their big pitches when they first launched Echo was, we can bring you streaming music through Amazon Music Unlimited. And if you're willing to only listen to that music on this device at home and not on your phone or in the car or anywhere else, then you can get it for the much, much cheaper price point of £4. So Amazon are using their Echo device to try and get a USP in the streaming music space. But the key thing is, with both Google Home and Echo, although by default they will try to make you listen to music on their own streaming services, you can say, hey Alexa, hey Google. I don't quite know what it is that you say. There are web pages and YouTube videos that tell you how to do it. But basically you say, stop playing me music on Amazon Music Unlimited, on Google Play Music, start playing me music on Spotify, and then they start playing you music on Spotify. I think with Echo, it only works on a Spotify premium account, whereas on Google Home, I think it also works on Spotify free, or it might be the other way around, I can't remember. But crucially, Spotify works on these devices, and it works on these devices by shouting at the voice-activated characters that run the devices. Whereas with the HomePod, once it goes on sale, not only will it be more expensive, because it's an Apple device, and one of the ways they're justifying it being more expensive is saying, well, it's a better speaker, which is another reason why music is very much part of their offer. When the HomePod goes on sale, you will be able to demand music from Siri through Apple Music, but not from Spotify. That will not be an option.
That said, if the speaker quality is your concern, well, the new Sonos One speaker has Alexa built into it. So that's already now a more attractive option. So it's a slightly dangerous game that Apple's playing in this case. Apple would argue that, as with their other devices, you can connect your Spotify or whatever to the HomePod via the AirPlay system and just control it with your phone or iPad or whatever.
Yeah, you sense Apple might be talking to any antitrust lawyers out there when they point this out, given that some people think that Apple being both the platform and the service, possibly there's some competition law concerns there. But yes, it's not that you won't be able to use Spotify on your HomePod like any other wireless speaker. You will be able to use Spotify, but you'd have to control it through your iPhone using the AirPlay technology. And I suppose the whole thing about these devices really is that it gets rid of the screen, it gets rid of having to tap onto a piece of plastic, and you can start shouting at it. And so the USP of these devices won't be available for Spotify-type services.
Well, yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? Clearly, all these companies are banking on voice control being the next big thing on the internet. And so if you do block people out of that, that could be a problem if it really does take off in the way that they seem to think it will.
And it's certainly true that it feels that Amazon, who, of course, were late to the streaming party, they had their MP3 store, but they were relatively late to add streaming into the mix. Initially, they did it as a sort of an added extra within Amazon Prime. They only really got to market with a proper Spotify competing streaming service last year. So they are late entrants to the market. But it does feel like, if we agree that worldwide on-demand premium streaming is currently dominated by two players, so Spotify by far the biggest, and then Apple Music second, it does feel like Amazon is already in third place and could actually catch the other two up. But Amazon's future in streaming is very much tied to its devices, to this Echo device. If Echo wins that battle between HomePod, Google Home, and Echo, and certainly here in London, it feels like they are winning it, although I've not gone into the figures UK-wide, let alone worldwide, to see if that's true. But it does at the moment. I mean, it's still early adopter stage with all of these.
Yeah.
But Amazon have various things going in their favour. It's reasonably priced. They have the platform to sell it. They already have everyone's credit card numbers. They can get coffee to your house in a way that Google and Apple can't. So it does feel like Amazon have a number of advantages here. And if they win this battle and they become the dominant player in the voice-activated home devices, on the back of that, Amazon Music could really steam in and become a really serious player in the streaming market, which is one of the many reasons why eventually Amazon could own the music business. But all of that said, I think people who are already Spotify subscribers will want to use Spotify on these devices. They won't want to start again, do their playlists all over, etc., etc. They will want to use Spotify on these devices shouting at it, because that's the whole point of these devices. So it's an interesting gamble on Apple's part, isn't it?
Yes.
Does it mean that Apple Music becomes more attractive because I can ask Siri to play me tracks with Apple Music? Or does it make the HomePod, which is already more expensive, a less attractive device to buy?
Well, I don't know, because I'm not massively attracted by any of them, but maybe. But anyway, we're not buying any of them at the moment, so we'll see. Still to come, Sainsbury's new vinyl-only record label and some news in brief. But now, recently, the Content Creators Coalition, or C3, as they are sometimes known, unveiled two videos which laid into YouTube. The Content Creators Coalition represents songwriters. Songwriters, as we've discussed, don't like YouTube very much for various reasons. And they announced these videos laying out their issues with YouTube to help try to build support for their campaign. And they decided they were going to place these videos as adverts on YouTube.
Yeah, let's use YouTube to diss YouTube.
That is a quite clever idea. I'm amazed people haven't done that already.
So C3 is one of the various organisations lobbying for safe harbour reform in America. Because although most conversations about the copyright safe harbour recently have been focused on the European Copyright Directive, obviously the American music industry and the artists and the songwriters and label publishers, they're trying to get American copyright law reformed as well. And so there are various organisations lobbying on this, but this Content Creators Coalition, C3, is one of them. And so there are these two videos. So one was focused on the value gap.
Yeah.
And then one was focused on sort of general frustrations with safe harbor. So the value gap one basically has three characters. One cool looking guy in the middle representing songwriters, and then a nice lady on one side representing every streaming service other than YouTube, and then a sort of really nerdy corporate looking guy who is representing YouTube. And they sort of basically talk about how the audio streaming services pay much higher royalties than YouTube does. And then YouTube, the character playing YouTube in this video, it then doesn't care about the fact the songwriter is getting paid in pennies rather than dollars. So that's the first video. So that's basically the value gap, isn't it? That's what the music industry has been banging on about all this year, about how the royalties paid by a Spotify and Apple Music are so much higher than a YouTube. And that's because of the deals the music industry has with YouTube. Why does the music industry have deals it doesn't like with YouTube? Because of this thing called Safe Harbor. The other one focuses in on the fact that under the Safe Harbor, anyone can upload content to YouTube, and it may not be their content. YouTube then streams that content, which technically is infringing copyright, but it can't be held liable for copyright infringement, providing it has a takedown system. And obviously, YouTube does. It's called Content ID. But what that means is any safe harbor dwelling platform, if you're a copyright owner and your music is being uploaded, it's your job to monitor that platform and take the content down. And lots of copyright owners, ever since the early days of websites claiming safe harbor protection, have moaned about this. The fact that it puts all of the onus onto the copyright owners, and that's not really the point of copyright law. The point of copyright law is, as a copyright owner, I can choose to opt in or not, whereas now I have to opt out, and that means I have to do a whole load more work. And so that is what the second video is about. I would say the second video is slightly misleading in that you have the YouTube character saying, oh, this thing called the takedown notice. Have you heard of one of them? And then the songwriter's like, what? I have to issue a takedown notice for every single time somebody uploads my song. That's way too much work. And it doesn't mention Content ID. And obviously, YouTube has spent a lot of money building this system, which helps artists, songwriters, labels, publishers manage their content on the YouTube platform. It's not perfect by any means, but it does mean, in theory, once you've taken down a recording once, every time someone else uploads that recording subsequently, then it should automatically block it. And it's not perfect. It's better for recordings than it is songs. We know that people who upload videos have ways around Content ID. So there are lots of frustrations with Content ID, but it is a pretty good system. And this video makes no mention of it. So in some ways, that's unfair on YouTube. And I don't know, part of me feels it sort of weakens your argument. It would almost be better to do something about the fact that there are weaknesses with Content ID rather than to deny its existence. Although I admit that that wouldn't make a very good video. And actually, these are quite good videos.
Well, they announced that they were going to put these videos up on YouTube a couple of weeks ago now. And then last week, they went online. Within 48 hours, the first one you mentioned, the value gap pennies versus dollars video, had been taken down. And C3 made a big fuss about that, although it did go back up again within a few hours. Although, see, they were framing it as, YouTube doesn't want people criticising it, so they wouldn't accept our ad. They've taken it down. Oh, and then they've backtracked because they've realised it's bad publicity. Although YouTube has a different version of events, we should note.
What we do know is that, yes, they uploaded these videos to various platforms. You don't have to watch them on YouTube. You can go and watch them on Vimeo if you like, although historically the music industry had plenty of issues with Vimeo as well, but that's another story. So yeah, they uploaded them on YouTube, and what we do know is that when this organization C3 tried to push those videos out over the YouTube advertising network, initially they were going fine, and then suddenly they stopped, and it wasn't clear why, and they got sent the automated notes that YouTube sends in these scenarios, which are never very helpful, but talked about term violations, violation of our terms and conditions and things like that. And then it got blocked, and then subsequently it started again. And so it was like, okay, were you trying to censor us? And then did you realise that that was really bad PR? I mean, on one level, you can understand why YouTube wouldn't want to help people diss YouTube.
Well, yeah.
But on another level, it's not a very good look to be seen to be censoring songwriters. But you're right. After C3 made people aware of the fact that their content had been blocked for a time, and there was a story in the New York Post that got quite widely read online, YouTube subsequently said, no, 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 no. Yes, the ad stopped being distributed on the ad network for a while, but that was an administrative issue, not an editorial issue.
They said there was a problem with the payment.
Something to do with billing. Then somebody we spoke to who is aware of the way C3 are managing their campaign said that as far as C3 are concerned, they weren't aware of any issues with billing, so that doesn't really make sense.
And they didn't do anything to fix any issue that they didn't know about.
It just suddenly started working again. So who knows what went on? But they are interesting videos to go and look at. You can critique them depending on which side of this debate you fall on. But it is quite amusing that this organisation are using YouTube in order to widely diss YouTube. And whether or not you want to buy the conspiracy theory that YouTube then tried to censor that content, or whether you're happy to accept YouTube's argument that that actually was an admin thing, and they're more than happy for people to use their platform to slag off their company, you can have your own opinion on that.
Yeah, and you can go and watch all those videos on our website, completemusicupdate.com, or if you go to setlistpodcast.com, you'll find the show notes for this show, and the link to the story will be in there. We've embedded the Vimeo versions.
Yeah, so if there is further wars between YouTube and C3 in the weeks
so
to come...
Our ones are safe, because as we know, Vimeo don't take anything down, do they?
Our embedded videos will work forever. So, yeah, you can go watch them there.
Just quickly, time for some news in brief. Songkick, back to Songkick again, but now Songkick Discovery, which is different to the ticketing business as previously discussed. Now they want to make that clear. Songkick Discovery, which is the bit that recommends you gigs, doesn't sell you tickets, and is owned now by Warner Music, is not going anywhere.
Yeah, they recently posted to their blog, because obviously there was all the reporting, and we talked about it on our podcast, about the fact that the Songkick ticketing company, that's the bit that is having a legal battle with Live Nation, and that's the bit that is shutting down. It will no longer exist. But as we explained, we went to great pains to explain on Setlist Podcast, there are now two Songkick companies. There is the Songkick ticketing company, which actually is no more, but there is the Songkick app, which actually is what I still believe most people think of when you say Songkick. That's the bit that got bought by Warner Music. That's the bit that is still operating. We said that on our podcast, but they took to their blog this week to say, we're still here, we're now owned by Warner, and we've got some great stuff coming up. Great stuff coming up, but we won't be selling you any tickets. It will go back to the original Songkick model, where if you want to go to one of the gigs it recommends you, it will always send you off to a third party ticketing platform to go and buy your tickets. I assume half the time that's Ticketmaster, because there are plenty of shows where basically Ticketmaster is the exclusive ticket holder. Of course, the other Songkick company heading into court later this month for what we're expecting to be a bit of a fist fight with Live Nation and its Ticketmaster company.
Bob Dylan, as you remember, won the Nobel Prize in Literature last year, and obviously anyone who wins that prize, people will eagerly await their next piece of literature. Bob has a new book coming out, which is his Nobel Prize winner's speech.
And why not?
So that's his new bit of literature, which has links to literature in that it was discovered to have plagiarised a study guide for Moby Dick. So that's that.
As you'll remember, if you listen to the podcast regularly, or certainly if you read the CMU Daily, Bob Dylan collecting his Nobel Prize and giving this speech. It was a very long, drawn-out saga, but he did finally write it. He didn't properly deliver it, did he? He recorded him delivering it, and there was a written version on the Nobel Prize. But he did finally get around to writing the speech, even if he nicked half of it out of a school textbook. So why not put it into a hardback book and sell it for $10, even though you can actually go and read and or listen to the speech for free on the Nobel website. But no hardback cover, and it's not properly literature if there's no hardback cover.
Virgin has, after 22 years, pulled its sponsorship of the V Festival, which essentially means that the V Festival is dead, and that is a good thing.
Yeah,
the V Festival is by far the worst festival in existence.
If you are a CMU Daily reader and you read our reportage on the end of V Festival, because Virgin are no longer sponsoring this annual event, you probably sensed that Andy Malty's not a big fan of V Festival. Because he used to live in...
I used to live in Chelmsford.
Which is where the southern bit happens. Also, it has
just
a site up in Staffordshire in the Midlands.
Such a terrible festival.
And you have some very happy memories of watching some top performances there. So V Festival now has various owners, but sort of Festival Republic, another Live Nation company, lead on it. They bought into the V Festival a few years ago. They are planning on still having an event in that time slot in the calendar. I don't know whether it will be at the same sites, but what we do know is Virgin are no longer involved, so it will not have the V. I mean, I don't know why Virgin owned the name V.
No.
It could still be V. Are there any other brands that begin with V that they can go and get to sponsor it instead?
No, none.
There must be another brand that begins with a V.
None.
And they could just carry on calling it.
Richard Branson said that they were going to go off and find new ways to disrupt the music industry.
They being Virgin rather than Festival Republic.
I'm not really sure how V Festival was disrupting the music industry, but apparently he thought it was. Although his fondest memories that he listed in his announcement that they were shutting down were related to Paul Weller playing and Stereophonics playing. I mean, given that V Festival has for quite a long time been more dance and pop focused, it suggests the other hasn't been for a long time, or he didn't really like it for a long time.
I have to say, like Tea in the Park, it was one of those brand sponsorships of a festival where you sort of forgot that there was it was just the V Festival. In your mind, it wasn't the Virgin Festival. I suppose they did have their branding on it. And at various points, different Virgin products. At one point, it was like the Virgin Mobile Festival, wasn't it, when they were pushing Virgin Mobile. But do you remember Virgin Cola? Is that still a thing?
I don't know.
I remember in the late 90s, early 2000s, when Richard Branson set up his second record company, which was called V2, which signed Stereophonics, hence why he was excited for them playing his festival. And they had a bar in their basement of their offices, which were over in Holland Park. And they used to do things there. And occasionally I would go to their things, even though I famously don't like social things. But occasionally
and
I would
go. And don't drink, so I don't know why.
And don't drink. No, but that was the point. So the only soft drink they had was Virgin Cola. You couldn't have Coca-Cola. You couldn't have Pepsi Cola. You had to have Virgin Cola.
They also had very strong German beer in there.
Did they?
What I vaguely remember.
That's what you remember.
Just about.
Anyway, V Festival no more. We look forward to seeing what the hell they come up with in its space.
You can read more on all of these stories and all the stories discussed on this week's show if you go and track down the show notes at setlistpodcast.com. There'll be links to all of them. And finally, this week, Sainsbury's is getting even deeper on the vinyl revival by setting up its own vinyl-only record label.
Yeah, you may remember that the supermarkets piggybacked on the vinyl revival a couple of years ago, about that.
Yeah, Sainsbury's got in there last March, Tesco's a bit earlier.
And they started selling vinyl records too, and at least one of them was selling record players alongside the vinyl. Anyway, it's been a huge success. Huge success, apparently.
Well, that's, you know, everyone's buying vinyl now.
That's what they keep telling us.
Everyone buys all their records on vinyl.
And most people love buying their records at the same time as cornflakes and shampoo. So it's been such a big success. And such a big success has the selling of vinyl in supermarkets been that Sainsbury's have run out of titles to sell. They've sold every single album that has ever been released on vinyl, and they've run out of titles, and the only solution to that is to set up their own record company.
Make their own records.
Make their own records. It is a JV with Universal and Warner. So it sort of feels a little bit more like it's doing an exclusivity deal with the majors to get some exclusive content. but they're setting up this label. But although we're doing our best to sort of diss this, because it's Sainsbury's setting up a record company that's only selling vinyl, that feels like something you should diss. Although...
when Tesco sets up a cassette label, that'll be...
That'll be
the killer.
The peak. But although it's in our nature to try and diss this, the releases they're putting out are quite interesting releases that I would quite like to see.
Well, I think, yeah, two things. One, they clearly have thought about this and have decided to go for a bit of credibility. And also, I think it says a lot about who is buying records in Sainsbury's. Because the first two releases will be two compilations put together by St. Etienne's Bob Stanley, also a noted pop historian, of course, who knows about putting together compilations. So he's put these two collections of classic music under different banners. So there's one called Coming to Los Angeles, A Taste of the West Coast, another High Fidelity, A Taste of Stereo Sound. Those are the first two things they're going to put out. I don't think they're planning to sign artists. I think it is the more compilation route they're planning to go down.
So perhaps they're trying to engineer the compilation revival as well as the vinyl revival and bringing compilations back, given that actually supermarkets, when they were sort of at their peak of selling CDs, compilations always used to sell particularly well there versus a more specialist music shop.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Bob Stanley, giving various interviews of this, talked about how it used to be great, you know, you go down the high street and they'd sell, as well as, you know, the actual record shops, you could go and buy records in WH Smith's or Woolworths or Boots. I mean, Woolworths used to have its own record label as well, and kind of talked about that kind of shaping his formative music experiences. I think the idea that this is going to shape any teenager's musical taste is stretching it a bit. I would say that their target audience is dads, not to suggest that other people don't like compilations put together by Bob Stanley, but I would guess if asked, it was dads that they were aiming for.
And that's what I was just thinking about the vinyl revival, that although there is evidence that there is a younger audience buying vinyl, and that's often the audience who don't actually own record players, and they're just buying it because there's something about it that they like. But when you look at the best-selling vinyl releases, usually they are catalogue releases, or they are heritage artists who appeal to an older demographic. So
yes.
I think, although there may be some hipster kids who are buying vinyl, a big chunk of the vinyl revival is the older demographic. But I suppose, to be fair, Sainsbury's, clearly they've done the research, they've recognised that, and they're creating a product which I think will appeal to that audience, and it will be interesting to see how it does.
Yeah, I mean, Sainsbury's, as we said, started selling vinyl in March last year, quickly claimed to have the largest share of the vinyl market of any retailer, which was 8% in 2016. They seem to think now it's dropped to 5%, but still reckon they're the biggest seller of vinyl in the UK. Since March 2016, they've sold 300,000 LPs, 120,000 this year, which shows you the extent of the vinyl revival.
Yeah, the footnote that always needs to come alongside vinyl revival.
No one buys vinyl.
Well, yeah, vinyl sales are up and that's exciting.
It is.
But look at the overall recorded music market. It's still tiny, 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 tiny chunks of money. And the profit margin on vinyl is great, and that's interesting. Although, having said that, it's freaking expensive to press the stuff, so it's not necessarily as lucrative as it initially seems.
That said, my experience of Sainsbury's vinyl, not that I've bought any, but it is that it's...
my experience of something I've never actually had any experience
of. A friend did buy some, and it was very low quality. So there's, I don't want to say they're intentionally pressing low-quality versions of the records they're selling, but the two that my friend bought were both scratched.
But let's not forget that that was when Sainsbury's was reliant on other record companies to provide them with their vinyl, whereas now they're going to be selling their own vinyl, so all those problems will be solved.
Yeah, well, that's all we've got time for this week. Subscribe, like, rate, wherever you found this, share it with your friends. Follow us on social media. You could email us, which I forgot, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. The show is presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.